Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Shame. An emotionally driven outcome of our own sense of failure. As having been unable to conform to a physical, mental, or moral standard, mostly of our own making, we re-evaluate ourselves in a very negative way and are left feeling guilty, distressed, powerless, and worthless. Shame can be a powerful motivator. It can guide us to greatness, wealth, power, and success, as the raw emotion we originally felt returns, causing our hearts to pump, muscles to tense, and nerves to tingle, even decades later. But the outcome entirely depends on the person, as even what seems like a meaningless moment of shame can trigger a personal crisis which can shape us for the worst. On Friday the 20th of March 1953, Rich Christie left his ground floor flat at 10 Rillington Place, never to return. During a decade-long reign of terror, 7 women, 1 man, and a baby had died. But their killer had never been caught. And with most of the victims having gone unreported, nobody knew that one of Britain's most prolific serial killers lived in Ladbroke Grove. And now, he had disappeared. Some of what follows is based on the killer's own memories and perspective. So what part of this story is true is up to you. My name is Michael, I am your tour guide, this is Murder Mile, and I present to you part 10 of the full, true and untold story of the other side of 10 Rillington Place. Today, I'm standing on the T-junction of King's Cross Road and Calthorpe Street, WC1, 1 mile south of the Regent's Canal, where the body of Sebastiano Magnanini was dumped. Parts of Paula Fields were found, and the mortuary where Glyndor Michael was reborn as a war hero. To my right is the Mount Pleasant sorting office. And that's it. There's a flat, a shop, a pub, but no people. No one comes here. It's dead. Even the postal sorting depot is being demolished, as they turn it into, yes, you've already guessed it, posh flats for overpaid tosspots, who won't stay here, but are willing to fork out $4,000 a month so they've got somewhere to dump their dirty pants, hide their hummus, quaff quinoa, shag their secretary, and all as a tax write-off. How romantic. Anticipating this rejuvenation, at number 1 Calthorpe Street, they've built the Crown Plaza, a 4-star hotel with restaurants, a gym, a spa, and a swimming pool. Ooh! With tourists on the inside and homeless on the outside, the only people in this area are either hobos or hoity-toity, vagrants or Volvo owners, tramps or fans of Taro Masalata, or drifters, and dullards who only live for the latest dross on Netflix. Before its demolition, on this site stood Roughton House. Built in 1892, Roughton House was one of five lodging houses in London, built by Lord Roughton, which provided a bed, warmth and food for London's low-paid workers and its down-and-outs. Being six stories high, in a stark Victorian style, with bright red bricks and sharp turrets, it looked more like an asylum than a hostel. But with 678 beds, at a cost of just one shilling a night, for many men, it beats sleeping on the streets. And yet, it was here that a bald, bespectacled little man, in a brown trilby hat and a fawn raincoat, would spend his final days of freedom. Born on the 8th of April, 1899, in Blackboy House in Accroydon near Halifax, John Reginald Halliday Christie, nicknamed Reggie, was the second youngest of seven children, with one older brother, four older sisters, and one younger sister, all born to Mary Hannah Halliday, a loving housewife and an overprotective mother, and Ernest John Christie, a working-class carpenter with a haughty demeanour, an explosive temper, and a burning desire for respectability. Therefore, it's ironic that as much as Reg claimed to despise his father, he would spend most of his life trying to emulate him, and when shamed by his own sense of failure, Reg would lie. As an officious man with a senior role in the Methodist Church, the Conservative Association, and later the Town Council, as the only person in the factory trained in first aid, Ernest was nicknamed Dr. Christie, a name he loved, as it alluded to him being a man of higher status in a middle-class profession. But to his son, Reg knew he had a lot to live up to. Unlike Ernest, Reg was small, skinny, and slight. A shy boy, with pale ginger hair and a limp handshake, and even being adored by his mother and protected by his sisters, he would become quiet, withdrawn, and suppress his anger. As being beaten for even the smallest of reasons, he hid in his father's shadow and lived in fear of his wrath. In fact, the only time that they spoke was while gardening, a hobby they both loved, giving Reg a rare moment of peace with his father, which he would cherish. In 1910, aged 11, as a good student who never got into trouble, kept to himself, and excelled at maths, Reg won a scholarship to Halifax Secondary School. Being bright but timid, just like his father, Reg threw himself into extracurricular activities, like singing in the All Souls Church choir and rising to the lofty position of King Scout and Assistant Scout Leader in the church's troop. And yet, for all of his hard work, his mother lavished him with love, but praise never came from his father. As a hobby, it may have seemed innocent enough, having achieved a high status position in the Scouts. But more importantly, it instilled in Reg the importance of rank, uniform, and status in winning over the trust and confidence of others. And this knowledge would shape the rest of his life. If the statements of Reg Christie are to be believed, there were three key moments in his upbringing which led him on the path to becoming a rapist, a serial killer, and a necrophile. First, in 1911, As part of a Victorian Methodist custom, the body of his maternal grandfather, David Halliday, was laid out for the family to view prior to burial. Having been petrified of this stern-faced bully, Reg realized that this motionless corpse could no longer hurt him. And from that point onwards, Reg became fascinated by death. Secondly, raised in an almost exclusively female household, during a sexually repressive era where nudity was taboo, during his childhood, he claimed he caught a brief glimpse of his sister's stocking top. And this brief thrill brought about, within him, strange feelings. And thirdly, as a sexually inexperienced 16-year-old virgin, Reg and two friends went to an infamous lover's lane in Savile Park, known as the Monkey Run. Having paired off with a young lady, who he would later describe as a mill girl of loose morals, although his chums easily copulated, Reg stood there, trembling and ashamed, his limp penis in his hand, as the girl mercilessly mocked him. As did his friends, as did anyone who knew him, as, at least in his eyes, across his hometown, his failure was marked with a chorus of kids chanting, "Reggie no cock, and can't get it up Christy." Reg wouldn't lose his virginity for at least another year. And for the rest of his life, he would fear sexual failure, hate morally loose women, and bottled up inside him would remain this shame. As a teenager, Reg seemed like an upstanding boy who graduated with a school certificate, worked as a projectionist at Green's Picture Hall, and also worked as a warehouse boy at a bootmaker's called John Foster & Sons. But inside, being raised as a repressed Methodist, Reg was a mess of deep moral conflict. On the 19th of September 1916, age 17, 2 years into the First World War, Reg enlisted in the 52nd Nottingham and Derbyshire Signal Corps and was posted to the Redmires camp in Sheffield. With a rank, a role, and a uniform, the army should have been his making. But he was never promoted, and yet claimed he had turned it down 3 times. He never excelled, and yet he claimed he had won many marksmanship competitions. And during his 16 months of service, he was charged twice for going absent without leave, having snuck off base to visit prostitutes. Women of loose morals, who he claimed to despise, and yet, in his eyes, they were the only women who wouldn't mock him, having been paid to be submissive to his needs. Having been mobilised 1 year earlier, on the 1st of April 1918, the 52nd Signal Corps was posted to Flanders on the Belgian front line, barely a quarter of a mile from the German troops, who were dug deep in their trenches. After 4 years of brutal conflict, the lush fields were a mess of muddy bogs, bomb craters, and jagged reels of barbed wire, on which hung the festering corpses of fallen comrades. As shells burst eardrums, bullets blew faces apart, boots sloshed in a sea of blood, and the acrid air was thick with the stench of decomposing bodies. In total, Reg saw active duty for just 11 weeks. But in that short traumatic period, he saw enough death to last a lifetime. Or so you would think. On the 28th of June 1918, Private Christie was injured when a mustard gas shell exploded near him. Having knocked him unconscious, plumes of the lethal chemical weapon swirled about him, choking him to death, as if, lying there, helpless and vulnerable, an overpowering force had gripped his throat. Having miraculously survived, when Reg awoke, The gas would render him blind for 5 months, mute for 3.5 years, and although hospitalized for 32 days, his voice was never the same. For his injuries, Private Christie was granted a weekly disability allowance of 8 shillings, and for his bravery, he was awarded the British War and Victory Medal. At least, that was the story that he told. In truth, his medical notes confirm he had no blisters on his skin, lungs, or throat. He was never treated for an eye injury, and that, having been diagnosed with functional aphonia, an injury caused not by gas inhalation, but by fright, there was no known medical reason why his voice remained as a soft whisper. And yet, his injury proved invaluable to elicit sympathy from women and to aid his story as an injured war hero. On the 22nd of October 1919, Private John Christie was demobilized from the army. That day, he lost his role, his rank, his uniform, and his wage. And with no skills, a small disability allowance, and an insatiable thirst for sex workers, Reg started work at Sutcliffe's Woolen Mill in Halifax, began dating Ethel Simpson, and on the 10th of May 1920, in Halifax Registry Office, she became Mrs. Ethel Christie. During those first few years of married life, Reg was shamed by 3 incidents, all of his own undoing. First, only able to become aroused by sexually submissive prostitutes, he failed to get Ethel pregnant. Second, being regularly unemployed and convicted twice for theft, he failed to provide as a husband. And third, having failed to live up to his father's high morals, he was disowned by his family. Feeling deeply ashamed, Reg left his hometown of Halifax, moved to London, and abandoned Ethel for 9 years. But his new life in the big city would start badly, and would descend deeper into despair and debauchery. In 1924, just 1 year later, while cycling in the West End, Reg was hit by a taxi, knocked unconscious, and suffered minor injuries to his right shoulder, left knee, and head. That same year, being unemployed, homeless, broke, and hopelessly addicted to sex, Reg was found guilty of 2 counts of theft, having stolen a bicycle, money, and cigarettes, and was sentenced to a further 9 months' hard labour. For the next 8 years, he tried to go straight. But being unskilled, he drifted between jobs, until once again, he was sent back to prison. But this time, his personality had taken a darker turn. On the 1st of May 1929, after 6 months of cohabiting with Maud Cole in her ground floor flat at No. 6 Almeric Road in Battersea, South London, being fed up with Reg leeching off her, Maud asked him to leave, as she and her son sat eating a meal of fish and chips at the kitchen table. Silently, Reg got up, as if to leave. But having swiped her son's cricket bat, he smacked her hard across the back of the head. Everything went black, blood poured from the gaping wound, and Christie forced his fingers into her throat as she screamed,
"Don't let him get me! He's trying to murder me!"
Maud survived the attack, needing only 5 stitches. 2 weeks later, Reg was tried at Southwestern Magistrates Court, and having claimed that this vicious and unprovoked assault was an accident, the magistrate branded him a liar and a coward, and Reg Christie was sentenced to 6 months' hard labour in Wandsworth Prison. In November 1933, a priest convinced Christie to break his self-destructive cycle and to turn over a new leaf. Convinced that the only good thing in his life was his wife, Reg asked Ethel to take him back. And with her affair to Vaughan Brindley over, and faced with the shame of divorce, they gave their marriage one last go. And so, in December 1938, the Christies moved into the ground floor flat at 10 Rillington Place. From 1943 to 1953, 9 people would die. A death toll which in any other era would raise an eyebrow. But having occurred during the London Blitz and the post-war chaos, as he preyed on the homeless, the penniless, the sick, the poor and the pregnant, for a whole decade, a serial killer walked the streets of London, murdering with impunity. And although, on the outside he exuded the arrogance of a man who was getting away with murder, on the inside, having been raised as morally decent, his ailing body was riddled with shame. Between 1937 and 1952, Reg Christie made 174 visits to the surgery of Dr. Matthew Odess in Colville Square, being plagued with fibrositis, diarrhea, headaches, and piles. And although, as a hypochondriac, who craved sympathy through exaggerated and imaginary illnesses, and visited his doctor at least once a month for those 15 years, his pattern of sickness has an eerie regularity. From February to August 1949, 6 years after the murders of Ruth First and Muriel Eady, being in regular work and good health, Reg made no visits to Dr. Odess. That September, having been told that his attractive 20-year-old co-tenant, Beryl Evans, was pregnant, his nervous diarrhea returned. On the 19th of November 1949, 10 days after Beryl and Geraldine's murder and the disposal of their bodies, Ridge returned to Dr. Odess complaining of fibrositis in the left lumbar muscles of his back. At his trial, Dr. Odess stated it was caused not by stress, but by physical strain, having lifted something heavy. From January to March 1950, across the trial and the execution of Timothy Evans, having complained of violent headaches and coincidentally memory loss, Reg was signed off work with depression. 2 months later, Reg was fit, well, and didn't return to Dr. Odess for almost a year. And then, in the 8 months prior to Ethel's death and his last killing spree, he would visit Dr. Odess 32 times. Very little makes sense in the final year of Reg Christie. In April 1950, he asked to be rehoused owing to ill health, even though there were 2 bodies buried in his back garden. In May 1951, he took out a life insurance policy on himself and his wife. But there would be no payout if she was missing or murdered. And on the 6th of December 1952, days before her death, Reg quit a well-paying job at British Road Services for no reason, and with no disability allowance or savings, he stopped his only regular income. Being broke, on the 17th of December, he sold her 22-carat gold ring and gold wristwatch at Barnett Pressman's Jewellers in Shepherd's Bush. On the 8th of January 1953, he sold most of his furniture to Robert J. Hookway for £12. On the 27th of January, he emptied Ethel's bank account of £10, 15 shillings and sixpence, having falsified her signature. And being 2 months behind with his rent, on Friday the 20th of March 1953, having rented out his flat, which he didn't own, to Mary and John O'Reilly at a cost of £7 and 13 shillings, wearing a brown trilby hat, a fawn raincoat, clutching 3 suitcases, and with Judy on her lead, Reg left 10 Rillington Place forever. And yet, there was one more death to come at the hands of Reg Christie. That day, having visited Ernest Jacobs at 132 Clarendon Road in Ladbroke Grove, handed over 5 shillings, produced his dog licence, and shown her badly infected eye to the vet. Even though she had been his faithful mongrel for 12 years, Judy was placed in the lethal chamber and put to sleep. By 8 p.m, having walked 5 miles from Rillington Place and checked into a 6-story lodging house in King's Cross called Roten House, here he gave his name, address, ID, and paid for 1 week, but only stayed for 3 nights. And as he lay on the itchy woolen sheets of a single bed in a dormitory full of 50 scratching hobos and snoring tramps, whereas once he was a war hero, a police constable, and a married man, now Reg Christie was nothing, with no family to turn to and no friends to trust. Mary and John Riley had a sleepless first night in their ground floor flat at 10 Rillington Place, as the trains thundered by and the lice scuttled along the walls. But what kept them awake was the smell. And having cleaned thoroughly and opened all of the windows, still, a fetid rotten stench lingered in the flat. Four days later, on Tuesday the 24th of March 1953, Beresford Brown, a tenant in the second floor flat, and was due to be moved into the ground floor flat as Reg had illegally rented it out to the Rileys, he was given permission by the landlord to renovate the kitchen. With his work cut out, as Beresford washed, wiped and stripped the filthy stinking kitchen, eager to nail up a set of brackets for his wireless radio, as he tapped on the rear wall, it gave a reassuringly solid thud. But 4 feet to the left, the wall sounded hollow. Given the shape of the room, and with its wooden door nailed shut, Beresford thought it was an old coal cellar, so eager for more storage space, as he pulled away a 6-inch strip of hastily stuck up wallpaper off the corner, with a small torch, he peered inside the darkness of the kitchen alcove. Prying open the alcove door, the police were greeted by a macabre sight of a naked woman kneeling, her back to the door, her feet folded under her buttocks, and sitting upright as if she was praying. Her dirt-covered body was kept erect by her bra, which had been secured around a ceiling hook. But as they moved her, they saw that she wasn't alone. In total, the bodies of 3 unidentified women were found in the alcove. All had been bound, raped, and strangled. And with their knickers missing, their pubic hair removed, and overcome by near-lethal levels of carbon monoxide, all had been asphyxiated with either a stocking, a tie, or a length of rope. Taken to Kensington Mortuary, their identification would pose no problem, as having been reported by her landlady, Hannah Rees, the next day, at 6:30 p.m, May Langridge of 80 Ladbroke Grove identified the body of her sister, 25-year-old Rita Nelson. At 7 p.m, a local prostitute known as Kitty Foley identified 26-year-old Kathleen Maloney. And having found in the dustbin a sports jacket, cufflinks, and a driving license belonging to Alexander Pomeroy Baker, at 8 p.m, Donald and Robert McClellan identified their sister, 27-year-old Hectorina McClellan. The crime scene was simple, and with the ground floor flat being small and most of the furniture sold, the search was swift and thorough. Noticing another strong, rotten stench emanating from the front room. As he wrenched up a loose floorboard, Chief Inspector Griffin discovered a fourth body. With her wedding ring missing, her bank account empty, and all of the neighbours stating that she was either in Sheffield, Brighton, Northampton, or Reading. At 4:30 p.m. that same day, Henry Waddington identified the body under the floorboards as that of his sister, 54-year-old Ethel Christie. And yet, 10 Rillington Place still had more secrets to reveal. 2 days later, when police lifted up an old metal dustbin in the rear corner of the garden, the bottom fell away, and out fell fragments of burnt and broken bones. Digging 2 feet deep, they found the skeletal remains of 2 unidentified females. But having been buried almost a decade ago, with no facial features, fingerprints, or ID, and with one skull missing, and the other smashed into 92 pieces, a positive identification would be next to impossible. Except, with the second skeleton matching a missing persons report dated the 4th of November 1944, and the severed second and third vertebrae matching a skull found in a bombed-out house at 133 St. Mark's Road, the body was positively ID'd as 32-year-old Muriel Edie. And having painstakingly reconstructed the badly smashed skull and spotted an unusual metal crown in her upper right molar, having identified this as the work of an Austrian dentist called Dr. Heinrich Blask, a surgery he had performed 23 years earlier, the first skeleton was positively identified as 21-year-old Austrian refugee Ruth First. And yet, 10 Rillington Place still had even more secrets to reveal. As the police searched a rubbish pile in the garden, amongst the burnt papers and charred clothes, they spied a small metal box of Lewis and Burroughs Gieslinter's pastels. Every lozenge had been eaten, and the box was empty, except for 4 matted clumps of pubic hair. Having exhumed her corpse in Gunnersbury Cemetery, the pubic hair didn't match Beryl Evans. Having checked her body in Kensington Mortuary, the pubic hair didn't match Ethel Christie. And although 3 of the matted clumps matched Rita Nelson, Kathleen Maloney, and Hectorina McClellan, a 4th clump of pubic hair was never identified. The grisly murders at 10 Rillington Place were front page news. The name on everyone's lips was John Reginald Halliday Christie, and his photo adorned every paper, emblazoned with the words, "Will the killer strike again?" as Britain was gripped with the terror that a sadistic serial killer was on the run. Only, he wasn't exactly on the run. On Tuesday the 31st of March 1953, at 9:10 a.m, Police Constable Thomas Ledger was patrolling the south bank of the River Thames, just shy of Putney Bridge, when he noticed a dishevelled man in a crumpled fawn raincoat leaning over the embankment wall as he idly watched a river barge being loaded. Growing suspicious that the unkempt man was a vagrant, PC Ledger questioned him.
"What are you doing here? Looking for work?"
"Yes, but my employment cards haven't come through."
"What's your name and address?"
"John Waddington, 35 Westbourne Gardens."
"Have you anything to prove your identity?"
"No, nothing at all."
Not believing the man's story, PC Ledger demanded,
"Remove your hat."
Which the man dutifully did. And being 5'8" tall, 54 years old, with a very recognisable bald head, thick-lensed spectacles, and false teeth which slipped, PC Ledger stated,
You're Christie.
Reg nodded. PC Ledger said,
"You better come with me."
And that was that. At 10:45 a.m. on the 31st of March 1953 at Putney Police Station, Detective Inspector Kelly charged Reg Christie with murder. And it was then, when prompted by overwhelming evidence, that he gave the bulk of his statements. Of the few items he had on his person was his marriage certificate and a photo of his wife. Having been declared sane and confessed to the murder of Beryl Evans, but not Geraldine Evans, the trial of John Reginald Halliday Christie began on Monday the 22nd of June 1953 in Court 1 of the Old Bailey. Tried on a specimen charge for the murder of Ethel Christie, when asked how he pleaded, Reg replied,
"Not guilty."
And although he remained calm throughout, his memory of the murders was patchy. At the end of the four-day trial, on Thursday the 25th of June 1953, having deliberated for just 1 hour and 20 minutes, the jury returned and unanimously found John Reginald Halliday Christie guilty. Transferred to Pentonville Prison to await his execution, although his grey prison fatigues were the only uniform in his life that he despised wearing, he adored the notoriety of being an infamous serial killer. Confined to the condemned man's cell, Christie whiled away his final days by playing dominoes, reading books, cutting out newspaper articles about himself, and he would happily discuss the details of the trial with his guards. Comparing himself to infamous murderers like John George Hague, and relishing the fact that tabloid newspaper, the Sunday Pictorial, offered him £27,000 for his life story. Although he was described as neat, friendly and quiet, an unassuming little man who spoke fondly of his wife, doctors concluded that he was a conceited egocentric with no remorse for any of his victims. And as witnessed by prison officer Joseph Hornsby, he was a deluded sexual predator. As when Officer Hornsby guided the prisoner to the toilet to urinate, Reg Christie turned to the prison guard, held his exposed penis in his hand, and said,
"The ladies love this."
On the morning of Wednesday the 15th of July 1953, in the execution chamber of Pentonville Prison, where 3 years earlier Timothy John Evans had been hung, at 9 a.m. precisely, with his execution having been meticulously planned so it caused no unnecessary distress, the executioner, Albert Pierpoint, swung open the twin trap doors, the prisoner plunged a 7-foot-6-inch drop, and with the dislocation of his third and fourth vertebrae, Reg Christie was dead. Unlike his victims, he felt no pain. Ironically, he was strangled by a length of rope. And as a man who struggled with impotence, it was his hanging which caused him to ejaculate. With new evidence having come to light, the murders of Beryl and Geraldine Evans were re-evaluated. Timothy John Evans was found not guilty, and with the British establishment rocked by the revelation that an innocent man had been executed, in 1965, the death penalty was abolished. 1 year later, Timothy John Evans was granted a posthumous royal pardon, and his remains were reburied on consecrated ground. The body of John Reginald Halliday Christie remains, to this day, buried within the walls of Pentonville Prison. And as much as his name is infamous in the annals of true crime, and his ghastly deeds have gone down in infamy, let us not forget those 10 names who history has cruelly consigned to being just mere footnotes in his dirty little life. They were Ruth First, Muriel Eady, Beryl Evans, Timothy Evans, Geraldine Evans, Ethel Christie, Rita Nelson, Kathleen Maloney, Hectorina McClellan, all of their unborn babies, and his mongrel dog Judy. This was their story. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for listening to Murder Mile. That was the final part of The Other Side of 10 Rillington Place. And because it was quite a complicated story, I'll be rolling out an omnibus edition of the series next week with all of the waffle taken out, as well as a special Q&A episode. So if you have any questions, please do contact me. And if you're a murky miler, stay tuned for some more mindless waffle after the break, as well as some important news about the Murder Mile True Crime Podcast. No, not that news. New news. But before that, here's my recommended podcast of the week.
The world can be a mysterious place. It can also be a boring place, so let's focus on the mysterious. Rusty Hinges is a podcast that explores mysteries, hoaxes, natural phenomena, and weird history. Basically, anything that's a bit, well, hinky. Season 1 topics include the tale of Clarence Roberts, a man who died more than once. And then there is the maybe kidnapping of June Robles, the sun that danced in the sky over Portugal, and an unsolved murder on the high seas. Rusty Hinges is generally skeptical, but never dismissive. Well, usually not dismissive. You can find Rusty Hinges on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. That's Rusty Hinges. R-U-S-T. You know what? I have faith in your spelling abilities, so go and subscribe to Rusty Hinges and maybe you'll solve a mystery. Probably not, but, you know, you never know.
I'm Javier with Pretend Radio, and this season, I'm embedding myself in a cult.
Throw him to the ground and get his devils out!
Many in the media have tried to get in front of the accused cult leader, Jane Whaley, and have failed.
We have asked you to leave.
But somehow, I got in.
How are you, sir?
Yeah, I'm here to speak with Jane Whaley. She invited me to service today. Yeah.
This season, we're going deeper into the Word of Faith Fellowship than ever before. This story is on a collision course, and it's not going to end well.
Why would anybody want to harm him?
Sometimes we hurt other people by hurting people they love.
Pretend Radio, Season 3, The Prophet.
What's the matter with us? We're not going to burn God's will!
A big thank you this week to my new Patreon supporter, Sarah Terrell, and to those brave souls on Patreon who are helping fund the next step of Murder Mile and the new exciting podcasts. Ooh. So thank you to Sarah and all my Patreon supporters. You are the jam in my Battenberg cake. Yummy. Murder Mile was researched, written and performed by myself, and with the main musical themes written and performed by Eric Stein and John Books of Cult With No Name. Thank you for listening, and sleep well.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Want to get a chiseled look in the jawline? Sculpt and shape your jawline with added volume from Juvederm Volux XC. Juvederm Volux XC is an injectable gel specifically designed to be robust enough to improve moderate to severe loss of jawline definition. And it is the first and only hyaluronic acid filler approved for the jawline. Add volume to your jawline for a chiseled look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you. Visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com.
Oh, oops, get up, Mike. Get up. There you go. Dun. Right. Where's my watch? How long did it? Oh dear, that took ages. Right. Watch. Okay. And. Welcome to Extra Mile. Hello, everyone. How are you all doing? You all good? You're diddling well. Good. Oh, dear. That was tiring. That was a long record. That was a long episode, that one. That's going to be a bugger to edit. It's Monday now. The Monday just before the episode comes out. So, yeah, I've got 3 days to edit this. Oh, it's going to be a long one as well. I can feel it in my bones. But there was a lot in that episode. There was a lot. What I did across the series was I gave you a lot of information, kind of bits and pieces, thinking I won't have to do too much in the final episode. But then I realised as I was writing the final episode, there was still a lot to tell you. There was a lot that I took out as well. And there's a lot that I have to remind you of from the other episodes. Do you know, because it's been, what, 10 weeks now? 2.5 months since we started this big old odyssey. So there's a lot of information, especially in the early episodes, that it's easy to forget. I've forgotten about it already. So, whew, out of breath. Got tea on the go, so I'll have to disappear in a second. Where am I at the moment? I'm middle of nowhere at the moment. Not really middle of nowhere. I'm far in West London, but I mean, I'm on a part of the canal that people ignore because they think there's nothing here. It just looks like there's a grass bank. But actually behind the grass bank is like a big Tesco's and a big B&Q and a big B&M stores. And there's a Costa Coffee. And, you know, there's everything you need there. It's all 5 minutes away. So it's actually a good place to hang out. It's a good place to hide. So I'm here. It's cold at the moment. The weather is it's gone past freezing, so the canal is slightly frozen up, but looking out now it looks like all the ice is gone. It's bloody cold, so I've had the fire on. No coot news. Coot was outside partway through having a little bit of a as he does, but he buggered off, which was good. We had the Blood Moon last night, so I know a lot of people may have stayed awake to watch Blood Moon, which is, I think it's when there's a transition of the sun and the moon and earth and blah blah blah, and the moon goes blood red. I couldn't be asked to stay up to watch it. I couldn't be asked to stay awake to watch a moon that's normally white go red. I'm just not that bothered, really. Couldn't be asked. So it's nice and peaceful here, and all very good. I'm trying not to get onto the next part of what I need to say because I'm waiting for my tea to done because I don't want to disrupt it. So all is good here, all is well. Hope you enjoyed the series so far. I've enjoyed writing this one. I enjoyed writing part 10 as well. It's been really good. I've had a bit of a giggle with it. I had to rein myself back in a bit, but. Hopefully that's good. You will have noticed. Hopefully, if I haven't checked the footage yet or the audio yet, but if I manage to make it work, the man who arrested John Reginald Christie, who was known as PC Thomas Ledger, of V Division PC number 400 down in Putney,
That was played by Police Constable Arsenal Guinness. Yes, the very same Police Constable Arsenal Guinness. If I manage to get the audio to work, because I was using a new recorder. So we'll see. If not, I've added it myself. I've played it myself. But we'll see. We'll see at the end. Obviously, I can't tell you now because I haven't edited it yet. But that was all good. Nice to meet up with Police Constable Arsenal Guinness last Monday, I believe it was. Yeah, last Monday we met up. We did a bit of recording. Because he's a copper, he was constantly looking out for crimes to solve, which is what he does. And then we had a couple of cheeky beers, which is very nice. Tea's brewing. Hooray. Hot. Oh, spillage. Nice bit of PG tips. Two sugar. I can't remember whether I put sugar in, so it's either going to be really, really sugary and sweet or not. And yes, even though it's winter, I've got powdered milk. I just can't be bothered with buying fresh milk. There we go, powdered milk. I don't mind it now. It's alright. It does the beers, doesn't it? I've got some bickies. I haven't got a cake today. I had a cake, but then I ate it last night because I was up until late trying to write this. I was trying to finish on Sunday night. I was trying to finish this mammoth of a script. It's a biggie. Normally they only go to 5 or 6 pages. This is about 8.5. It's about nearer to 10 before I edit it down. Right, got my tea, got my bickies. These are McVitie's digestives, the milk chocolate ones, not the dark ones because I'm not a heathen. Good. Okay, let's crack on with the stuff that we do. Normally I'd crack into some info on Christy that we'd normally do. I'll do something else instead. So, tea slurp. Murder Mile update. So, this is obviously the last episode of the last part of The Other Side of 10 Will Into Place. As mentioned, we will do the Omnibus Edition next week. It might have to be in 2 parts or possibly 3 because it's the 10-parter and I can't seem to upload more than 2 hours per episode through my podcast host. I don't know why, so there we go. So it may be in 2 parts, and then we'll do a Q&A episode as promised. So if you've got any questions, please do. Some people have already. I can't promise to read them all out, but I'll certainly try my best. Now, as you know, as mentioned in part 8, and I've mentioned it on social media as well, this is the last episode of the Murder Mile True Crime Podcast. If you're shocked by this, and you don't listen to Extra Mile, it was all in the Extra Mile for part 8, and I mentioned it at the end of part 9, and I'm mentioning it again now. And it's on social media as well, so I'm sorry if you missed that, but Murder Mile True Crime Podcast will be coming to an end. I know I was meant to do another couple of seasons, but I'm just exhausted. Absolutely exhausted. It's killing me. But big thank you to everyone who sent through really lovely comments. I hope I've got through to everyone so far. I've tried to reply to everyone, but obviously I wasn't expecting so much kind of love from so many people that, you know, it was a lot. There was a lot going on. A lot of people really... And not just, oh, we're going to miss you. Really, like, people had really taken their time to really write me really lovely messages. So I've tried really hard to reply to everyone. But if all I've done is ticked a like, I have read it. It's just, it all came in all at once. And I'm still, to this day, like a week on, probably longer, like 10 days on, still replying to emails, which I plan to keep doing. So thank you to everyone. The love you show me has just been absolutely fabulous. And really great. And it's, you know, it's given me a chance to have a little think about what I want to do. And although I can't continue with Murder Mile, and you know my reasons why, I've kind of said that last time. I do still love Murder Mile. And clearly you guys still love it as well. So, I'm thinking about doing this. This is something I think about doing. I can't come back and redo Murder Mile as a weekly thing. That's just not possible at all. And what I do need to do is take a break and go off and write these other podcasts and get the new podcast off the ground and then get the second one off the ground and do things like that and keep myself busy. But there's still loads of stories I want to tell with Murder Mile, do you know? So, what I'm thinking I may do is return with Murder Mile with specials. So, things like the Blackout Ripper, things like 10 Rillington Place. So, every so often, instead of doing like a weekly or a monthly, every so often what I'll do is just... I'm not going to hold myself to dates at the moment, because I think that was what's freaking me out with Murder Mile at the moment, is just, you know, being forced into this, having to do one every single week and being stuck with it. So what I'm thinking about doing is returning with specials. So every so often, every 3 or 4 months or whatever, I just go, right, here we go. Like, you'll get a promo saying this is coming next week, and then like for 3 or 4 weeks you'll get a multi-part series. So that's what I'm thinking about doing at the moment. So it may not be a farewell Murder Mile. It may just be a bit of a long hiatus. Maybe that's what I need, is a bit of a hiatus. And you know what? Maybe if that goes well, maybe I return doing monthly podcasts with Murder Mile. So I have all my other podcasts, but then once a month I do a big case. I don't know. Maybe that's what I do. Because Murder Mile is labour intensive, but if I did it over a month... Or I did a multi-parter over 3 months. You know, yeah, that's probably easier to do. And it means I don't have to say goodbye to Murder Mile, which I still do enjoy and love. So, don't hold me to that. But that's kind of my thinking at the moment. And I think, do you know what? Having had some time off, I'll probably feel a lot better about Murder Mile. At the moment, it's nice to write this episode. I really enjoyed writing this episode. The last one was a bugger. I really hated it. Just it felt like a drag, but this one felt like a last hurrah, and I really enjoyed writing this one. You know, the love for Murder Mile is still there. So here's my bit of advice for you. I'm obviously next week I'm going to go away, getting my boat repaired. I've got a week of boat repair, so I'm going to go radio silence, because I literally have got to focus on repairing the boat. But you've got more than 60 Murder Mile episodes out there, which are still up. They're all going to stay up. The episodes aren't going to go anywhere, although I need to contact my podcast host today, because all of my stats seem to have disappeared. Although all the episodes are still there, I'm just hoping they haven't deleted my whole account or something. I think it's just their stats system has gone down. Because I've got like 60 plus episodes, if you want to... listen to the back catalogue of Murder Mile. If you listen to one a day, by the time you finish that, doing all 65 episodes, I think it's 65 roughly or something like that, by the time you've done one of those a day, I should have the new series up and running, which I still can't tell you much about because it's still a bit hush-hush. So that should be up and running. And then, you know, by then I'll probably be feeling a lot better, and I can probably start writing some Murder Mile specials in my spare time. So I'll keep all of the Murder Mile accounts up. So nothing definite yet. Don't hold me to any dates, because I think with Murder Mile I'm going to keep it a bit free form, because it's such a complicated thing. I think what I should really do is just focus on getting it right, as opposed to rushing it to get it out by a set date. So you know, If you listen to things like fantastic series out there, like Secret History of Hollywood by Adam Roche, he does like one episode once every 6 months. But and there's no real date or rhyme or reason when he releases them. But when he does release them, it's like Christmas. It really is. They're so beautifully done. I'm listening to his multi-part series on Val Lewton, and I think we started listening to it about a year and a half ago, maybe 2 years ago. I'm still listening to it now, and it's still fabulous. So, you know, I like the way that he does that. That he kind of, you know, he releases it when it's ready, as opposed to, you know, going, oh, got to get it done by next week, which can be a bit of a bun. It's fine if you sit there and just waffle about something you read on Wikipedia, but when you want to get, like me, if you want to get the research right and you want to get, you know, the sounds perfect, you know, there's nothing worse than rushing it. So, to that, I know, all change. You know me, I never stick to my plans fully. So, all change on the Murder Mile, but not all change-ish. So, this was an idea from Police Constable Arsenal Guinness, when I think we're on about a sixth pint probably.
we were thinking then about having a farewell party for Murdermar, but really it's not a farewell party anymore. But I still like the idea of doing that. So sometime in April, I'm probably thinking Saturday the 6th of April of this year, 2019. Obviously, if you're listening in 2020, this happened ages ago. Thinking about how somewhere in London, a pub in central London, that evening, a chance, I'll put it on social media. I'll try and put it on the promo for the new podcast. Hopefully that'll be up and running by then, so I can kind of say to people, if you're in London, come along, come and meet me. I'll invite along some other podcasters as well. And it'll just be a nice evening, have some drinks, have a chat, get some Murdermar badges and goodies. I've got bloody loads of them. So that'll be exciting. So no more information on that now, because it's only just mulling in my head, but that's exciting. At present, I still have some mugs available. There's only about 8 left now. If you want them, go to my website. Or if you're going to book on my tour, you can book a mug and a ticket as well for the tour. You can do that. I only have 8 left. Just to say to anyone who has bought mugs, I apologise. I've just noticed recently, I lifted up one of the mugs and I was like, what is going on? There seems to be something weird, something sticky on the bottom. And I realised, even though I'd stored them in a very dry and very cold place, because all the mugs have sweets in them, the bloody Fox's Glacier mints, all of them had melted into like mush and they'd all leaked through. And I didn't realise. So I sent out loads of mugs, and because they weren't leaking, I didn't realise that they'd leaked inside. So I've cleaned them all now. All of the new mugs have been cleaned. I've got rid of all the mucky sweets. But if anyone has bought mugs and they are full of mucky muck, let me know and I'll replace your goodies. The mugs, I think, I've wiped them all down. They're easy to clean. But if your stickers are ruined or your tea bags, or message me and I'll send you some new stuff. So sorry about that. I've only just realised. That was a lot of breath. Right. Let's get down to some Christie stuff. Oh, I hope if anyone's on my Murder Mile True Crime Podcast discussion group on Facebook, I hope you like the picture I posted the other day. That kept me very amused. I posted a picture of a nice villa in the 1950s, 1960s in Barbados. I linked a picture saying this was Reg Christie's holiday home in Barbados when he was released from prison, and they publicly apologised for convicting him of crimes he was innocent of. That was just a bit of fun. I thought I'd throw that up just to tease people. Some people got it. I don't think everyone got it, but I do enjoy having fun. So, Reg Christie stuff that I didn't put in. There's some stuff here that I've tried to put in so often I just haven't been able to find space for it. So, in 1951, so before Ethel Christie died, but after Timothy Evans and Beryl Evans and Geraldine Evans died, in the first real flat was a lady who was known as Pat. Her real name was Joan May Howard. She was 25. She lived in the first floor. She was quite pally with Ethel Christie. Now, Ethel Christie, when they would like put out the laundry or stuff in the back garden, you know, to dry it off, Ethel Christie would mention to her about the Evanses and about everything that went on there and stuff like that, and the fact that the wife and her baby were murdered, and you know, it was a bit grisly. Pat found it quite grisly. Ethel showed Joan, her nickname's Pat, photos of Beryl and Geraldine that Reg Christie had taken. And every time she would do this, Ethel Christie would get a little bit upset about it. A few days after that, Pat was having tea with Ethel and was being shown cuttings related to the case, because obviously Christie kept all of the cuttings. As I mentioned, Joe, he was very... He loved himself, he loved his name, things like that. And Ethel had stated to Pat that their relationship had gone really bad since the case. And she even said to Pat, Ethel felt sure that her husband had done it. Now, whether that's true, because this was said post Christie's conviction, But that's what Pat said, who was the neighbour there. As we know, Christy was a keen photographer. I tried to get this into the final three episodes, the kind of all the stories about, which is why I mixed up the order at the end, because I wanted to show that Christy was manipulating people through his photography, as he had done with Beryl, as he did with Kathleen Maloney when he took them, those ladies to the photographic studio and simulated sex with them. I wanted to show that this was a theme, but I couldn't get it into the series, which is why I mixed the order around to get Kathleen Maloney first. But I ended up not putting it in. But Christy was a keen photographer, as we know. One day, when his wife was present, Christy asked to take photos of Pat with her cat and dog, which he did. He then asked to take some nude photos of her, which she declined. Ethel was present in the room at this time. Now, this caused a bit of a rift between Pat and Reg Christie. A few days later, when Pat was with her boyfriend in the flat, this is the first floor flat, he was an RAF corporal called John Walter. Christie accused her of being a prostitute. This is something he did a lot to women who spurned his advances. And he screamed, "The only place for women like you is dead. If I had my way, I would do it." And apparently this was said in Ethel's presence as well. He later threatened her again when she returned, saying, "Remember what I said, I'll do you in." Obviously this was said post Christie's conviction. So a lot of these, how much can you really believe? It is really hard to tell. Did she go to the police prior to that and say, "I've been threatened"? No. So... as we know, he was a war reservist policeman, a special constable in London. He started that on 1st of September 1939, which was the start of World War II. And he ended his service 28th of December 1943. So that was after he had murdered Ruth First and Muriel Edie. Obviously, he'd spent a lot of time during World War One, he'd seen a lot of bodies on the front line, the 11 weeks he was on there. He had a fascination with death. He would often say that it was quite fascinating, Joe, pulling bodies and body parts out of buildings. There was a lot of death going on. But also around the time of World War Two, because there wasn't a lot of policemen, hence police war reservists. There was a lot of crime going on, a lot of looting, a lot of bribery. So this was a really good opportunity for him to kind of engage into his criminality that he had before. But also, it is said, although whether there's truth of this, although I think we know Christy enough to believe this, an opportunity to for him to grope and fondle dead bodies. This also gave him regular access to prostitutes. Now, even though as a police reservist, his job really was to track down petty thieves and deserters. Obviously, he had regular access to local prostitutes. And although, you know, they always said he was commended twice for, you know, and he was a very good and useful officer. It was here that he learned to do his first aid, which became very useful for him. But it is said he would pick up prostitutes on his duties. Now, one other officer, I haven't got his name here, complained to the sergeant, saying that Christie was always turning a blind eye to prostitution. Now, this is almost possibly entirely true, as it is said that he had several relationships with local prostitutes whilst he was married to Ethel, so during this period. So he actually used and abused his, as we've seen already, his position as a uniformed man, as rank and all stuff like that, in order to get what he wanted. In fact, he would use his authority as a policeman to get whatever he wanted. He loved to lord it up in front of people with his uniform, even though he wasn't a proper policeman. He was, you know, a reservist. It is said there wasn't a single person on Rillington Place who he didn't threaten to turn them in for, you know, petty offences, you know. Obviously, if you were getting... There was a lot of black market stuff out and about. Then, like, normal people would, you know, because there's rationing going on, normal people would, you know, if a mate goes, "Oh, do you know, we can get you some tea bags, or, do you know, we can get you some good meat that's outside your rations," do you know, that's black market, so that's illegal. But, you know, the average person would do it because, you know, they need to survive. But Reg Christie would dob them in. He was that kind of arsehole. Right. Going towards the trial case, so obviously near the end of this, I couldn't get in all the details about Reg Christie's trial. I mean, that could be an episode in its own right, but I did get to the point of thinking this should be another extra parter, but I thought, let's just end it now. I don't want to drag this out any further with extraneous details. So, as I mentioned before, Reg Christie's, his whisper is, you know, they couldn't work. There was no medical reason why he still had a whisper, because he only had functional aphonia. And they said it was catarrhal laryngitis he suffered with, which they solved with a mist expectorant. So basically a menthol mist on his throat for 3 weeks, and that would have solved it. But for some reason, he still had his little whisper for the rest of his life, which a lot of doctors said was put on. There was an incident just before his father disowned him, where he shouted at his father and his voice was loud. It was loud and, you know, booming. But on at the end of the third day of the trial, Christie's trial, just after lunch, I like the way it's written here, it says just after luncheon, Mr. Heaney, who was the capital officer, was guiding Christie back downstairs from courtroom one back down to the cells, which were immediately underneath courtroom one. It kind of made it easier to get the accused in and out. He grabbed Christie by the back of the arm to guide him downstairs, which was his job, and Christie turned round to him and barked in a very loud and what they described as a vicious voice, not a whisper that he used throughout the court case. He shouted, "Take your bloody hands off me," in a really loud and booming voice. So it very much was put on. He could not have his little whisper voice if he wanted it. As I mentioned on here as well, Christie was charged for the murder of Ethel Christie, and this was a specimen charge. I've used the phrase specimen charge before, but in case you missed it, I'll reference it again. If someone is charged with multiple offences, the prosecution and the defence can make a decision about what the best way is to go. Either you can charge Reg Christie with all of the offences, all of the murders, which means you have to charge him 9 times, which can be a real pain in the arse, because, you know, if he's found guilty of the murder of Hectorina McClellan, but he isn't found guilty of the murder of Rita Nelson, because, you know, there could be an imbalance in the kind of the... someone's got their engine on. Because of the imbalance in kind of the evidence that's available. Because that can be a little bit dubious and a bit all over the shop, sometimes it's easier just to have a specimen charge which says, I'm going to charge you for the murder of, in this case, Ethel Christie. And if you are found guilty of the murder of Ethel Christie, therefore, by default, it is said that you've committed all these other murders as well. Now, quite often, for both the defence and the prosecution, this is kind of the best outcome, because it saves a lot of time, it saves a lot of money, it saves a lot of manpower, but also, it's kind of like, you know, if, for the defence, if he's found guilty of the murder of Ethel Christie, that's fine, you know, he's found guilty. If he's found innocent, he's found innocent of all the other crimes as well. They can't charge him for all the other murders, so it actually makes sense to have a specimen charge. The court kind of appreciates it as well. It makes more sense. So that's why he was charged with the murder of Ethel Christie. When he was on remand, so when he was arrested, before he was sent to Pentonville Prison, after he was found guilty, he was at Brixton Prison. Brixton Prison, which is where the Blackout Ripper was held. And the principal officer, J.C.M. Matheson, who we've mentioned before with the Blackout Ripper, he interviewed Reg Christie at least 3 times at length, and he was the man who deemed him sane and able to stand trial. He said there didn't seem to be any hint of insanity at all. He clearly, which is not to say he's not a nut job, but it's just to say he knew what he was doing. It's very clear. That's the difference between sane and insane. Do you know what you're doing is right and wrong? And Christie clearly knew that it was wrong, but he still did it. So he was deemed fit to stand trial. And even though he was also examined by Dr. Jack Hobson and Dr. Desmond Curran, both of them declared that he was a severe hysteric, a gross hysteric, and that he had a large capacity for disassociation. Which is interesting, when you look at Christie's statements, there's very much disassociation going on. He distances himself from the fact that these people, that they're real victims, real people. And that he believes that they sexually wanted him. That was his big thing, that it was all about, you know, his whole life was really just about sexual desire, and it's being seen as kind of a great sexual power, and etc. I love using the word etc. Just might as well just say full stop. Okay, so during his psychological evaluation as well, Christie was given the Rorschach test. If you know about that, that's the ink blots. So they're not just random ink blots. They're basically very carefully defined ink blots. They're mirrored. It's a mirrored ink blot. It looks random, but obviously when you look at it, the psychiatrist says, what is it that you see? And, you know, most of them look like butterflies or things like that. But it really is, when you look at it, what you see is a reflection of your internal workings. So this was done on Christie. No information was given to the doctor in advance about who the man was at all. He just sat him down and said, okay, what do you see in these ink blots? And when the results came back, the doctor said that Christie was a sad, unhappy, and rather inadequate, anxiety-ridden little man with a sufficiently well-structured personality to have survived life in a circumscribed narrow level, and that he probably suffers from psychosomatic complaints, a good deal of aggressiveness and regression. Which is pretty accurate, actually. Very accurate. So that was that. On Christie, when he was... this is all the personal stuff he had in his cell before... after he died, obviously, his cell was cleared. Most of his stuff was destroyed because he didn't have any next of kin, really. And kind of no one really wanted it. They didn't want it to become mawkish souvenir, so most of his stuff was destroyed. A few bits were held by the police, but that was it. So of his personal possessions, he had 17 letters... one telegram, I've no idea what they are. I haven't got it written here at the moment. Two birthday cards, because it had in the April, just passed in the April. That was his birthday, so we only received two birthday cards. I believe one of them was from the publican of the Cider House in Harrow Road, I believe. Two religious tracts, because don't forget he was a Methodist. Four newspapers, because he loved reading about himself. Two pairs of spectacles. Interestingly, when they checked his vision, he had what they describe as six out of six, which means he had pretty good vision, but he chose to wear really thick glasses. Interesting. Spectacles case. He had one tobacco tin. Although he claimed that he didn't smoke, he did smoke. He had a tendency to smoke Mankin cigars as well, which are kind of quite a cheap brand. One photograph of himself in the army, which he kept on his wall, which was interesting. That was one of the few photographs he had, which was him in his early days. So obviously that's the moment in his life where he felt the best and the most proud and things like that. To his name, he had 1 shilling and 10 pence, which ain't a lot. What would that be today? That's probably not. That's probably barely even a pound. Probably barely even a pound. I think 30 shillings... was equivalent. I can't think about it at the moment. As well as his clothing, as mentioned before, he also had his marriage certificate with him and a photo of his wife. When he was given an autopsy, obviously they have to give him an autopsy, even though they know how he died. He died by hanging. Everyone who was executed has to be given an autopsy to prove that the death was correct. And when they checked him, he had 2 operational scars, a small scar on the inner side of his left knee, and a scar on the top of his right shoulder. So those would be the scars from when he was knocked off his bike in the West End in 1923. It was proved that he had seminal emission, as they called it, so he did ejaculate. That does happen when you're asphyxiated by a rope, even if it's a fast death like that, you do ejaculate. Effusion of the eyes, so his eyes were all bloodshot. His last meal basically contained alcohol, so it was believed he had a whiskey, although they didn't mention that. Quite why this is on the autopsy, but it said he had a well-developed penis and he was uncircumcised, which is always useful to know. I guess they put it in there because, you know, whether the belief is that he was a rapist and all that because he had a tiny penis or something like that, but obviously not. He had no hint of venereal disease, which was interesting given the amount of prostitutes he slept with. And death was instantaneous. And when they checked his EKG, which was prior to his execution, they said that he had an abnormal rhythm in his heart, which was interesting. We've found that a couple of times with a couple of the people that we've mentioned in these murder cases. When their heart rhythm has been checked, they have an abnormal rhythm. So whether that is important, I don't know. Deep breath. Right, getting to the end. According to my neighbour's moving away. I got no neighbour. Oh, boo-hoo. According to the psychological report by J.C.M. Matheson, who's the principal officer at Brixton Prison, principal medical officer at Brixton Prison, Christie had to render his victims unconscious before he could have sexual intercourse with them. Otherwise, there was a risk that he would that they would witness his impotence and his sexual inadequacy. Which, that, I think, really sums up the whole case. That's it in a nutshell right there. Literally is, when you go back to the start, it's the desperation to be as good or better than his father, who was desperate to be seen as middle class and in a good profession. So that was going on there. The repression, living in a repressed Victorian era with his family where sex wasn't discussed, that kind of thing. And then the Monkey Run incident, whether that's true, we actually don't know. That was Christie's words, but it could be true. It sounds logical that, you know, he couldn't get an erection when he was trying to have lose his virginity to a girl. And they all call him Christy No Cock and Reggie Can't Get It Up. And that is the start of his sexual inadequacy. So that was interesting, I think. I think that, I think that sums up Christy. So, core dear, that was... that was a lot of work. So I hope you enjoyed that. That was The Other Side of 10 Rillington Place. Ooh, a 10-parter. That was good, wasn't it? That was good. So, as mentioned, next week, going to do a omnibus edition. There'll be a Q&A, so message me. You can contact me on social media or email or, you know, there's about a billion ways to contact me. Message me. Hopefully soon I'll know more about the kind of not quite farewell party, but, you know, it'll be like a podcasters get together or something like that. That'll be good fun. And then hopefully we'll know more about the new podcasts and, you know, maybe some Murder Mile specials as well. So that'd be interesting. There's a lot of big stories I was planning for season 3 and 4, which I wouldn't mind trying to get to. So, okay. That was Extra Mile. That was Murder Mile. I will see you next week for what I think I might title as the almost but not quite farewell Murder Mile episode. So, thank you to you all. Have a good week, and I will see or hear or not from you all soon. Wishing you well. Bye-bye.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.